Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Sam Mirajovsky, partner at Sam & Ash Injury Law. Teen driver safety is an important issue, and Sam & Ash Injury Law is hosting a teen safe driving essay contest with some pretty amazing prizes to encourage teen safety. Hey, Sam, thank you so much for being here today.
Heather, it's my pleasure. Great to be with you.
So, among all the law firms in the Valley, what's unique about Sam & Ash Injury Law?
Well, we're high energy, client focused, community focused people. Ashley and I are real humans. We both live here and work here in a beautiful valley. But we also, you know, we bring a lot of expertise with us. We've been both had long careers outside of Sam & Ash, and we got together and wanted to build a law firm centered around the client and not around the egos of the lawyer, not around, you know, some sort of image that everybody seems to be trying to have. We're just here to do quality legal work to help people get better and put their lives back together after suffering an injury. And then, of course, we want to make the community better. We want to make Las Vegas better. We love the city so much and are proud to call it home. So I think we're a different kind of firm, and certainly the kind of firm that a lot of people have come to trust over the years.
Nice. Okay. Now, what inspired you to promote safe driving for teens?
Well, I have a teenage driver now at home, and I don't know if anybody out there listening, if they can relate to this. Every time that my teenager is out on the road, I am very worried. Now, he's a great driver. He's a safe driver, but still, he's a new driver. And there's a lot of bad driving here in town in Las Vegas. I can vouch for that, given my job. And I'll tell you, I think that for teens, one of the things that is really easy to do is you don't appreciate how quickly things can go bad out on the road. So distraction, cell phones, you know, emotions, things going on, teenagers are more likely to get into accidents, and not necessarily even by their own fault, just because they're not paying attention, not appreciating the dangers of the road. So what we're trying to do here is get young people to think about safety and bringing it to their attention, the forefront of their minds, to keep themselves safer, and of course, to keep everybody else on the road safe as well.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I can totally relate myself. My son just turned 16 and he's going to be taking his driving test in just a few weeks, actually. So
This
is very, very timely for me.
Yeah. It's scary. But by the way, it's great because they get this independence, right? And it's important. They can help you out, all that good stuff. It's been a great experience for us at home. I'm just saying, I'm a little scared for him when he's out there on the road and, you know, obviously praying for his safety.
Yeah, I totally get it. So tell me more about your Safe Teen Driving Essay Contest.
So it's really simple. It's a 400 to 500 word essay. You can submit it at samandashlaw.com/safe driving. And it's an essay where you tell us what safe driving means to you. Now, to qualify, you've got to be 16 to 22. So, you know, your son would qualify, provided that he's in a Clark County education program. And so 16 to 22, enrolled in a Clark County education program. And the prizes, there's going to be a few different winners here. You can go to all the details online. But basically, the top prize is a 2024 Volkswagen Jetta. So you can get a new car if you win the top prize here. And I obviously want to thank our friends over at Finley Volkswagen. They're just incredible partners and do so much good in this community. So they've helped us put this together. And then we are offering also up to $5,000 in scholarships, a year's worth of free car washes in partnership with the WOW Car Wash folks, gift cards, and so much more. So there's some other prizes here too in play, and really hoping that we get some good submissions and we get young people thinking about what safe driving means to them.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. So what impact do you hope that this contest will have on young drivers?
Well, I hope that young people will think about this beyond just an abstract concept that you take in driving school and, you know, rules of the road and that kind of thing, that they're aware of. And I'm hoping, right, when you're putting together a paper, a quick, you know, it's not long, it's 400 or 500 words, but still doing a little bit of research, appreciating the dangers out there, thinking about the real life consequences of your actions behind the wheel, and hopefully build some better habits and reduce, you know, distractions and a culture of accountability. That's something that, you know, we learn as we get older, how, you know, you got to be accountable for your actions, and hopefully this gets young people thinking about it a lot sooner.
Yeah, for sure. Now, working in injury law, you probably see some sad scenarios. What are some of the biggest mistakes that you think teen drivers make?
I'm convinced the number one, and it's adults are guilty of it too, is the phone. You know, the phone is a distraction. A text comes through and you take your eyes off the road for a second and everything can change. Everything. Somebody can dart out in front of you. People here, you know this, people do not always respect crosswalks. People are running red lights. And you have to, even if somebody else is making a mistake, you have to be aware of what is going on around you all the time. You cannot be texting and driving. You just can't be doing it. And so many accidents here are preventable. And I can't stress that enough. The other one, of course, is alcohol. And, you know, a lot of kids go out and party and get caught up in that scene. It's so important to never drive intoxicated. Obviously, you shouldn't be drinking underage to begin with. But if you do, get a ride. Uber, don't get behind the wheel. Tragedy for everyone follows that decision. And it's really, at that point, it's not an accident. It's a crash. And it's something that you could have avoided.
Yeah, definitely. Now, how long is the essay contest open for entries?
Yeah, great question. Saturday, December 21st is when it closes. So still have plenty of time.
Yeah, nice. Okay, so you did give the website, but let's tell it again. Where can people go for more information or to enter the Teen Safe Driving Essay Contest?
Yeah, you can go to samandashlaw.com/safe driving. samandashlaw.com/safe driving.
Awesome. Okay. So once again, that website, samandashlaw.com/safe driving. You can find out all the information there about the Safe Teen Driving Essay Contest. It's going from now until Saturday, December 21st. Plenty of fantastic prizes, including a 2024 Volkswagen Jetta, $5,000 scholarships, free car washes for a year, all kinds of amazing prizes that you can find out there. It's a 400 to 500 word essay for kids who are 16 to 22 years old in a Clark County education program. And once again, the website, samandashlaw.com/safe driving. And we've been speaking today with Sam Marajofsky, partner at Sam and Ash Injury Law. And Sam, I really appreciate you being here and letting us know more about this fantastic Teen Safe Driving Essay Contest to promote safe driving among our teen drivers, not just your teen and my teen, but all the teens in the Valley. So thank you so much for your time today.
Heather, it's my pleasure. And thank you so much for helping us get the word out. It means a lot.
How was your drive to school?
Let me tell you, I had to get my iced coffee first. I just can't seem to put it down. My favorite rapper just announced a tour. My phone was buzzing like crazy. I'm so excited. I had to text all my friends right then to talk about it. Then someone started calling me and...
Let's try that again.
I turned my phone off right away. I never drive distracted.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
I'm Heather Vail, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Dr. Dylan Wint, director of the Cleveland Clinic's Lou Ruvo Center for Brain Health in Las Vegas. November is National Alzheimer's Awareness Month, and Keep Memory Alive, part of Cleveland Clinic Nevada's philanthropy department, is raising awareness and funds through their Month of Memories campaign. Dr. Wint, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me and for your interest.
So I think everyone's familiar with the unique, twisted-looking architecture of the Lou Ruvo Center for Brain Health, but what exactly happens there?
Yeah, that's a great question because it is kind of hard to tell from the outside, isn't it? Well, the primary thing that we do is we take care of patients who have neurodegenerative diseases, specifically Alzheimer's disease and related memory and cognitive disorders, movement disorders like Parkinson's disease, and immune disorders that attack the central nervous system, like multiple sclerosis. So as part of offering patients that care, we also provide caregiver services, education, social work services, and we do research here into better ways of diagnosing and treating these conditions and hopefully eventually curing them. And then we offer education to the community, to medical professionals, and to trainees to try and ensure that wherever someone with one of these conditions goes, if they meet a provider who is knowledgeable and prepared to help them.
Nice. So then what exactly is Keep Memory Alive?
Keep Memory Alive is a foundation that supports the work that we do here. Keep Memory Alive originally started when Larry Ruvo, in honor of his father, Lou Ruvo, had a dinner about a year after Lou's passing. And one of his friends gave him a check and said, "Want you to do something about this terrible and devastating disease, Alzheimer's disease." And other people at the table, in fact, I met another gentleman who was at the table just today. Other people pulled out their checkbooks and their wallets and purses and started writing checks. And so Larry started a foundation that eventually was directed at setting up a place where people could get care, where their caregivers could be supported, and where research could be done into these diseases. So Keep Memory Alive is the philanthropic arm that puts on these events and supports the work that we do here.
That's awesome. And what is your Month of Memories campaign all about?
So Month of Memories is a community-wide fundraiser. It's held during November, which is National Alzheimer's Disease and Family Caregiver Awareness Month. So during the month, retailers and bars and restaurants will offer specialty items. They can be cocktails, usually purple, because that's the sort of theme color of the month and the theme color of Alzheimer's awareness. But cocktails, dishes, retail items, and a part of the proceeds from selling those goes to support Keep Memory Alive and the things that we do here to help care for people who have Alzheimer's disease.
Okay. Who are some of the participating restaurants and other retail partners who are part of the Month of Memories?
So there are several restaurants. So people have probably heard of Delmonico Steakhouse, Emeril's New Orleans Fish House, Lee's Discount Liquor, the Macy's in Green Valley, Village Pub and Cafe at Ellis Island in New York, New York, and a number of others.
Okay, so besides going to these restaurants and bars, how can community members get involved or contribute to the fundraising efforts as part of Month of Memories?
Well, we do have a Texas Hold'em charity poker tournament that will be held on Friday, the 8th, November 8th, at our event center, that Twisted Steel Building. And that's an amazing event because it's hosted by Jack Binion, who is a legendary casino founder and owner, and seven-time World Series of Poker bracelet winner, Daniel Negreanu. He's also known as Kid Poker. So they'll be hosting. There will be a skills tutorial at 5:30 that night, and people can buy a seat for that tournament for $800.
Okay, awesome. Now, let's talk a little bit about Alzheimer's because it is National Alzheimer's Awareness Month. So how prevalent is Alzheimer's disease?
The Alzheimer's disease affects somewhere around 6 to 6.5 million people in the United States. In Nevada, there are about 55,000 Nevadans with Alzheimer's disease, and it affects about 15% of people who are over age 75. So it's really actually quite common. It's the fourth leading cause of death, and it's the only one of the top 10 leading causes of death where the number of deaths actually increased over the past 20 years.
Wow. Okay. And what are some of the signs and symptoms of Alzheimer's disease that listeners should be aware of?
Yeah, one of the typical core features of Alzheimer's disease is rapid and complete forgetting. So people can, within the space of minutes or hours, completely forget something that they've been told or that they saw. And the way this often shows up is people will repeat questions or repeat statements, or will seem to be unaware that something that happened actually did occur. Because the information goes into their brain, their memory system doesn't hold on to it, and then it's gone. And so for them, it essentially never happened, whether it's a conversation, a visit, filling out paperwork. So I mentioned repeating questions. People can miss paying bills or will sometimes pay bills multiple times. They can miss appointments. They can get lost. These are all features of that forgetfulness. And then there can also be other cognitive changes. People may struggle with reasoning things out or handling stepwise processes. And there can be behavioral changes too, irritability or apathy, which is sort of a decrease in motivation, less likelihood of sort of coming up with and executing activities during the day. Depression and anxiety can also be components of the onset of Alzheimer's disease.
What should we do if we suspect a loved one might have Alzheimer's?
Well, I think one thing is to definitely talk with that loved one. And just, I would start by asking them if they're observing anything that's changing. And then not to think about it as, you know, let's go see what's wrong with you, but to think more in terms of, let's find out what threats there are to your cognition and what we can do about those threats. Because the goal isn't really to identify disease or get someone on a medication. The goal is ultimately for that person to live as happy and as functionally and as safely as possible. And part of that might involve finding out if there's a memory disorder. But we don't want to make it about the negative. We want to make it about the positive. We want to make this life as full as can be for as long as can be. And early diagnosis and intervention are part of that. And then, of course, bring it up with a medical professional. Primary care providers are able to do what's called cognitive screening, brief tests that can identify if someone's memory or other thinking processes may not be where they would be expected to be performing. They can also, very importantly, do testing for reversible causes of memory change. So there are hormone and vitamin deficiencies. There are medications that can make someone more likely to have trouble with their memory and thinking. And there are times when correcting that abnormality fixes the memory problem.
Okay, great advice. Where can our listeners go for more information about Alzheimer's disease, Keep Memory Alive's Month of Memories campaign, or sign up to play in the Texas Hold'em fundraising poker tournament?
For the poker tournament, they can call 702-263-9797 or email specialevents@ccf, that stands for Cleveland Clinic Foundation.org. And then to find out more about Cleveland Clinic Nevada and the things we do here and to get access to education programs, ccf.org/Nevada.
Okay. Awesome. So once again, those websites, ccf.org/Nevada. CCF stands for Cleveland Clinic Foundation. So ccf.org/Nevada is the local website, and that includes what they do at the Lou Ruvo Center for Brain Health in Las Vegas. And then if you want to take part in the Texas Hold'em fundraising poker tournament, you can call 702-263-9797 or email specialevents@ccf.org. Or if you want to find out more about everything that Keep Memory Alive is doing, the website for that, keepmemoryalive.org. That's keepmemoryalive.org. And during the month of November, for National Alzheimer's Awareness Month, they are holding the Month of Memories campaign, which includes participating restaurants and retail partners who are giving funds to the Keep Memory Alive Foundation. So all of that can be found at keepmemoryalive.org. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Dylan Wint. He's the director of the Cleveland Clinic's Lou Ruvo Center for Brain Health in Las Vegas. And Dr. Wint, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know more about what you're doing at the center, especially for National Alzheimer's Awareness Month and the Keep Memory Alive Month of Memories campaign, so that members of the community can help give back as well. So thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you again for having me. I enjoyed the conversation.
I taught for 20 years until I started forgetting my lectures.
Eventually, he had to quit. Getting his early Alzheimer's diagnosis was hard, but it gave us time to take control of the situation together.
I can't imagine going through this without him.
If you or your family are noticing changes, it could be Alzheimer's. Talk about seeing a doctor together. For more information, visit alz.org/time-to-talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and I'm Heather Vail. Joining me is Dr. Chris DiRienzo, Chief Physician Executive and Senior Vice President at the American Hospital Association, or AHA. A new report from the AHA finds that hospital safety and quality were better in the first quarter of 2024 than it was before the COVID pandemic. Dr. DiRienzo, thank you so much for being here today.
And thank you so much for having us.
So what exactly is the American Hospital Association?
The American Hospital Association is a group that stands for nearly 5,000 hospital and health system members across the country. And that membership is really broad and wide. There are many different kinds of hospitals who participate in the work of the AHA, and we strive to advance the work of the field.
Nice. Okay. Now, what are some of your most important findings from your recent report?
This report was really important for us to work with a partner on. Vizient, who ran the data for this patient safety insights report, works with thousands of hospitals around the country on patient safety and quality data. And we partnered with them because we wanted the public and policymakers to be able to see what our members could see themselves. We know that hospitals are committed to driving improvement every day, and they could see that in their internal data. But we hadn't yet had the ability to see that on a national scale. And this report includes hospitals across the country, 49 states and the District of Columbia, as small as 22 beds and as big as 1,500 beds. So it is broadly representative of the fabric of hospitals in America. And as you indicated, there are numerous outcomes that we were able to show improvement in the first quarter of 24 compared to before the pandemic.
So what do you think caused this improvement in safety?
I think it's two things. I was the chief medical officer of a health system during the pandemic. And while COVID challenged us in incredible ways, many, that we couldn't have possibly have conceived of before walking through them, there was an undercurrent of improvement that continued. I remember being in our hospital command center in North Carolina, where I live, in those early days of the pandemic, and we were doing everything we can to serve our burgeoning COVID population. And we also had these improvement efforts that were continuing, that had started before the pandemic, continued through the pandemic, and now have continued after the pandemic. And so that undercurrent, that drive to improve, has always been there. And you can see that reflected in the report. The second thing, and one I'm excited to get to talk more about, is innovation. We know that in healthcare, we have to continually innovate to improve. And as we've talked to hospitals around the country, each approach to innovation is slightly different because every hospital and every community that it serves is slightly different. So there are individual stories of innovation and improvement from all over America that compound one on the other to lead to the outcomes we see in this report.
Okay. So what types of innovation have you seen?
We have seen in the Southeast, for example. I was talking to a hospital recently who has incorporated new approaches in their emergency departments and in their inpatient units to drive reduction in death from sepsis. Sepsis is one of the most severe kinds of conditions that hospitalized patients can come through the ER with, and it carries a really high risk of death. And this hospital has done a ton of work to drive that risk of death down. Up in Maine, we've seen some incredible work on team-based care that was highlighted in Newsweek recently. And Maine General's approach to drive that team-based approach has led to substantial improvements. I could go on and on and on and on, but it's stories like this that when I was in a hospital leadership role, you just don't really talk about much because your head's down, focused on your operations, focused on your community. And so this report gives us a chance to help lift up some of those really important local stories.
Yeah, definitely. How do the types of illnesses treated in 2024 compare to those pre-pandemic?
One thing we asked Vizient to look at in this report was, how does the patient population compare? And we know that we walked through a whole lot of challenges during COVID, including an entirely new population of patients with a completely new condition that for the early part, we didn't know how best to treat. And it turns out that even as we've walked through, that multi-year challenge, on the other side of it, hospitals are caring for more patients than we were in 2019. And when you look at the resources we use to care for them, which is a good measure of patient acuity or how sick they are, those patients are actually sicker on average than they were in 2019 as well.
Okay, so more patients, sicker patients, and yet hospital care generally still got better.
That's exactly right.
Interesting. Okay, what do you expect this trend to look like going forward?
I don't think this is a declaration of victory of any kind. The story of improvement in healthcare is generational. And so the trend that we saw in the decades before the pandemic of continuing improvement, it continues today. And my specialty is neonatology. And if you look at the risk of death for a preemie back in the 1960s and 70s, it was incredibly high. Even the son of a president of the United States who was born a couple of weeks premature died just a few days after birth. Today, if that child were born in America's hospitals now, their chance of survival approaches 100%. You know, it's 99.99 something percent. That's the story of improvement. It's innovation, it's improvement, and it goes on in every kind of hospital in every state across the entire country. And so that trend will continue because we know the commitment to drive it continues.
Nice. Okay. So where can listeners find out more information about the American Hospital Association or your report findings?
Yeah, we would both love for folks to see the report itself. It's available on our website if you'd like to download it. There's been a story in Newsweek recently that highlights some of those local stories from hospitals themselves. But one thing I would also encourage listeners to do is connect with their local healthcare community. Again, every hospital has a story of improvement, and it's these kinds of national data that help bring to light what those efforts look like, you know, for your listeners in Las Vegas or for listeners in states across America.
Nice. Okay. And what's the AHA website?
Very simple. It's aha.org.
Perfect. So once again, aha.org is the website for the American Hospital Association, aha.org. You can find out more about what the American Hospital Association does, and you can also access the report findings that we've been talking about today regarding the safety of hospital care and how it has changed now compared to pre-pandemic. So aha.org is the website to go to. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Chris DiRienzo. He's the Chief Physician Executive and Senior Vice President at the American Hospital Association. And Dr. DiRienzo, such really fascinating information you've shared today, not something that a lot of people would have just guessed if you didn't have the data to back it up. So I really appreciate you being here, sharing the news with us and talking it through. Thank you so much.
It's been a privilege. Thank you so much for having me again today.
Hey, life doesn't stop when cancer starts. After diagnosis, treatment is vital. But for some, just getting there to appointments, chemo, or radiation is a major challenge. You can change that. Volunteer to give rides with the American Cancer Society Road to Recovery program. Driving for a few hours of your day can make a life-saving difference for someone with cancer. Visit cancer.org/drive to learn more.
I'm Heather Vail, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me from the Leadership Conference Education Fund are Tierra Bradford, Senior Program Manager of Justice Reform, and Esteban Camarena, Field Manager for Census and Data Equity. With Election Day on top of us, it's important for citizens of all demographics to make their voices heard. The Leadership Conference Education Fund's And Still I Vote campaign is making a final push to get everyone out, especially young voters of color. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
So what is the Leadership Conference Education Fund?
What we strive to do is build public will for federal and state policies that promote and protect the civil and human rights of all people in the United States. We empower and mobilize advocates around the country to push for progressive change in the United States. And we run a coalition of over 240 plus other national organizations who believe in the same civil rights principles we do.
Okay. And what exactly is the And Still I Vote campaign?
So And Still I Vote is a campaign from the Leadership Conference. It's an initiative and it aims to really empower communities, particularly young people, women of color, and people of color to engage in democracy by voting, becoming poll workers, and being part of the electoral process. The campaign emphasizes that voting is a powerful tool to ensure leaders reflect the values of our communities. And as you mentioned earlier at the beginning of this call, there's a lot at stake at this election, and so it's important to really get everyone and anyone out to vote who is qualified.
Yeah, definitely. What are your priority issues for this election?
Something I work on is justice issues. And we know that's something that folks who are between the ages of 18 and 35 really are really interested in and really passionate about. And so at the Leadership Conference, we have our Vision for Justice platform that basically talks about the different policy recommendations that we have on the state and local and federal level for different changes that we want to see from arrest to reentry when it comes to justice issues. And so something that we try to do is share this information, educate young voters about our platform, and in turn, let them know that justice issues are always on the ballot when they're voting. Like, these policies that they want to see, they could see these happen if they use their power and their right to vote to see these changes in their communities. And so we're talking the mayor. The mayor picks who the head of the police department is going to be. You can vote for your sheriff. You can vote for judges. Those people directly impact the policies in the justice system. And so if people care about the criminal legal system, the justice system, then they should really care about voting.
Yeah. Now, when you're talking about justice issues and policies, what exactly are you looking for to happen in those policies?
Yeah, well, so we have 18 different planks in our platform that discuss different policies from arrest to reentry. But one of the main things we like to talk about is community safety and public safety. So instead of just, you know, focusing on traditional public safety, which that would be police, looking at things that prevent crime from happening in the first place, and that could be investments in like wellness programs, after school programs, things that really keep the community engaged and away from criminal activity. Also, when we think about community safety, we think about alternative response. Not every crisis or issue that happens in a community needs the police presence. Sometimes it could be handled by a mental health professional or someone else who's trained in crisis response. And that can direct people away from the criminal legal system. And so community safety and doing things that kind of prevent people from entering the system and prevent harm from happening is just one of the many types of policies that we discuss in our platform.
And besides justice reform, what issues should young voters of color prioritize when they're voting?
I think it's really important to connect the voting with different issues that young voters care about, whether that's education. So a lot of people are concerned with their student loans. So that can be something that can really drive out folks to go out and vote. The access to abortion is definitely one that is top of mind for many communities. And there's definitely a lot at stake at this election. So it's important to really get everyone out. I work specifically on counting all communities. And that is really making sure that we are working towards a fair and accurate count in the 2030 census, as well as advocating for data policies that really help people reflect themselves in the data so we can see the data, analyze the data, and really help formulate policies based on accurate data.
What kind of data are you looking at that's going to inform these decisions when we get to the voting?
Well, that's a great question. And just as a heads up, we don't actually collect data. We just promote policies that collect race ethnicity data. So with the recent standards from OMB being updated earlier this March 2024, we really have the opportunity to engage with all communities of color to really reflect themselves in the data and race ethnicity data. So that comes from the U.S. Census, the Decennial Census, the American Community Survey, and different other federal surveys that really help us determine, for example, populations in geographic areas, to determine voting polls, to determine roads, to determine schools, hospitals, you name it. So we really need this data to really help advance data equity and help advance some of the justice goals that Tierra just mentioned.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. So where can listeners go for more information or to get involved in the And Still I Vote campaign?
Yes, if folks want to know more about the Vision for Justice platform and more about the criminal legal system and justice issues, they can go to visionforjustice.org, which has the different 18 planks that discuss different justice policies. And also there's a toolkit if folks want to get involved in those types of policy changes in their communities. Also, if they want to learn more about the Leadership Conference, they can go to civilrights.org.
Folks can also visit endstillivote.org to make sure you are registered, informed, and ready to vote by November 5th.
Nice. Okay. So once again, those websites, if you're interested in justice issues and policies and what the Leadership Conference Education Fund has provided, visionforjustice.org will give you plenty of information about that. visionforjustice.org. You can also visit civilrights.org to find out more about the organization in general, civilrights.org. And if you're interested in the And Still I Vote campaign, visit andstillivote.org, andstillivote.org. And we've been speaking today with Tierra Bradford. She's a senior program manager of justice reform for the Leadership Conference Education Fund, and also Esteban Camarena, field manager for census and data equity. And I want to thank you both so much for being here and bringing some important issues to our awareness and emphasizing again how important it is for everyone to get out there and vote, regardless of age, regardless of ethnicity. Everyone needs to have their voices heard. So thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. And I just want to emphasize that early voting has started in Nevada. So if you have your ballot, definitely go drop it off or go vote in person. And thank you for the time. We really appreciate it.
One of our biggest problems today is that we are afraid to have others challenge our mindset, and therefore we avoid topics that could lead to challenging conversations. At a young age, we're told not to talk about anything that is remotely divisive, but without having challenging conversations, how do you know that what you're saying is your truth and not just something you were raised to believe? Having conversations is how we learn. It's important to be able to see the other sides of things in order to form an opinion and choose what's best for you. Let's say you were raised to shower with all your clothes on. You could go throughout life thinking that is the best way to get clean. And if you never meet anyone brave enough to talk about hygiene, then you may never know that there is a better way. There's no reason to be afraid of differences. Limiting yourself to certain topics can render yourself unable to talk to friends, coworkers, or even family. To avoid challenging conversations is the same as to keep your mind trapped in a little box. Open your box and start having more civic conversations.
Civility. It's an American thing. From AmericanThing.org.
From Odyssey, in partnership with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, welcome to I'm Listening, Talk Away the Dark, a special conversation about mental health and suicide prevention in the Hispanic community. Odyssey's Liz Hernandez from 94.7 The Wave is joined by American Foundation for Suicide Prevention expert Vic Armstrong and AFSP supporter and mental health advocate Gabby Vargas for this meaningful conversation. Now, Liz Hernandez.
Hello, everyone. I'm Liz Hernandez. Welcome to Talk Away the Dark. We are going to focus on mental health and suicide prevention within the Hispanic community. I'd like to welcome our two guests today, Vic Armstrong and Gabby Vargas. Hello. So I'd kind of like to set the floor first with Vic, you introducing yourself and your expertise, which is so important for today's conversation.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm Vic Armstrong. I'm Vice President for Health Equity and Engagement with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And my work with AFSP spans across our communications work, our policy work, and our programs work, helping to bring clinical and equity expertise across that work. And a large part of that is really looking at how we can develop programs and initiatives that really relate are more relatable to historically marginalized communities.
Beautiful. And Gabby?
My name is Gabby. I am currently the founder and owner of Poema Studio. It's a community mental well-being space in Elgin, Illinois, and home to a not-for-profit that I founded about 2 years ago, the National Hispanic Suicide Prevention Network. And we focus on mental health awareness and overdose prevention, as well as suicide grief support, supporting families that have lost someone to suicide. And I'm also a proud volunteer for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. I am a bilingual talk Safe Lives presenter for AFSP. I'm just really proud of the work they're doing, and a collaborator with me now in spreading the awareness within the Hispanic community.
And the heart of this really starts with Gabby's story, because you yourself are a suicide survivor?
At the age of 25 years old, I faced a severe mental health crisis. At that point, I was already a mother to two young boys, and I felt trapped. I was in a place where I was a very young mom going through a divorce, and I planned to take my own life. I do thank God and all the great people in my life that came through for me at that time. And out of shame, I kept that attempt a secret, never imagining that a year later, my 18-year-old cousin would take his own life. And his loss led me to seek professional help. It also let me see the importance of mental health, especially in childhood. And so that was the beginning of my healing. That was the beginning of a time in my life that I was able to see firsthand within my family how suicide loss affected all of us in different ways. And so seeing how much pain, you know, came from it, it made me realize that I needed to get professional help, and I didn't want my family to go through another loss, at least not my loss. And that led me to get professional help. So now that I've been in the field, I've realized how much we need to speak about these topics. And I love the topic, the name of today's topic, Talking Away the Dark, because it took me to share the darkness of my story to be able to get the help that I really needed. And now I'm able to do that within my community. But you know, becoming a loss survivor, I also got to see how little of support existed for survivors within my community. So working firsthand with families has allowed me to find a purpose and just give back now and be that person that I needed when I contemplated suicide myself.
What were some of the factors that led to sort of the snowballing effect of feeling that there was no hope?
Yeah, so, you know, looking back in my life as a small child, I had two great parents that loved us and that provided, you know, with what they had at the moment. And I do think that a lot of my upbringing that was within a religious household, some of those things affected us in the way that we asked for help. You know, sometimes within our church, we were told that, you know, if you were struggling, if you were sad, you weren't doing the right things in front of God, or you were just, you were made to feel shameful for not being okay. So for me, it was that. Also, you know, we were struggling to survive, I would say. So, you know, you don't really want to worry your parents any more than they already are worried about things in life. Culturally, you know, we don't really talk about mental health. I think, you know, we laugh about it a little bit now, but I remember when we did share with our parents about certain things we were struggling with, it was always like, well, you know, you're here now in the United States, you speak English, like you're in a better place, like you have nothing to complain or worry about.
Gabby, I want to put a pin in it right there really quick, because I want to ask Vic Armstrong about the cultural impact of this idea that we can pray things away, or that, you know, it's shameful to seek outside resources. Can we help talk about that stigma and what how important it is to remove that?
Yeah, and I think that theme of not talking about mental health and emotional challenges, and especially in Black and brown communities, is a theme that I hear a great deal. And I think as myself growing up, the son of a preacher, I heard that narrative a lot. I didn't grow up hearing, you know, today we're talking about talk away the dark. What I heard growing up in my community was what happens in this house stays in this house. And we, you know, we try to encourage people to call a hotline. And I still remember, you know, hearing all you need is prayer. All you need is faith. If you had more faith, you know, you wouldn't be going through these things. And I think what sometimes can look a little different, I think, in Black and brown communities is that oftentimes the resources, the culturally relevant resources that speak to who you are, and they really can contradict and counteract some of that narrative, doesn't always exist in our communities. And so that narrative, that stigma, really has room to breathe. And we end up relying on the things that we feel like are tried and true. That's our faith. That's our church. There are churches in the community. And so we've grown accustomed to going to the church and relying on the church for other needs. And so that narrative that you don't need mental health services, you only need faith, is one that is very common in a lot of communities.
Yeah. And that can be, you know, harmful to only seek one resource, because I do believe a spiritual practice can be a very beautiful thing in our healing and support, but we also have to seek professional help as well, especially when we're in a very dark place.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of what gets lost in the narrative. And in part, it's because we don't always have resources reaching into historically marginalized communities, whether Black and brown communities, rural communities. We don't always have resources reaching into the communities that can really push back on that narrative, or resources where we can reach out oftentimes for mental health resources, and especially mental health resources that have cultural relevance. And when we don't have those things, it really becomes more of an inward facing conversation. And again, it allows that stigma to grow. But I do want to your point about faith-based communities, and I'm sure Gabby can attest to this too, there's a role for the faith-based communities in addressing these challenges, because the same way that folks turn to the church for their spiritual needs and emotional needs, there's also an opportunity to turn to the church as a conduit for connecting folks to mental health needs. We just need to work with our faith-based communities and educate our faith-based communities, I think, on how to be more of a resource to the people that depend on them.
We can't be afraid to have these conversations. So Gabby, let's then fast forward to where now you are witnessing someone in your family lose their life to being in a really dark place. And that was your wake-up call.
It definitely was, especially because he was so young. And a lot of times we think, you know, they're so young, they have everything. Like, what could possibly be wrong in their life, right? So for me, it was that I thought, like, if he followed through with it, what's going to stop me next time? And, you know, going back to talking about resources, a lot of time we're afraid of where those resources may lead us. Like, is it going to be in the system? Is somebody going to find out about them later? Especially when you are living within a family that is undocumented. A lot of times families are afraid of asking for help because immigration might be involved or the law enforcement might be involved. And so for me, I think that what stopped me from getting resources was the fear that somebody's going to find out something that I don't want anyone to know, right? And so it is difficult. It is difficult to let it all out, but I am so glad that I did. And I will forever be grateful for my therapist, who I think changed my life. And going to see a therapist allowed me to work on things that I hadn't talked about since my childhood. It allowed me to become a better mom, to be more present. You know, I was at that point when I almost took my life with my kids, because it would have been a murder-suicide. I remember working at a hospital, being a young professional, but I had a lot of stressors in life that I never shared with people. Like, here I am working in a hospital as a Spanish medical interpreter, and the theme or the thing they would always tell us was, our patients come first, you know, you're here to help and serve. And so it was also very difficult for me as a healthcare professional to say, I'm not okay, and I'm struggling. And, you know, that was something that I hid behind a smile. You know, patients come first, so let me make sure my patients and my job are okay. And I would go home and just feel completely, you know, I was like not present for my children. And so getting professional help allowed me to see that I wasn't the only one struggling. My children were struggling. You know, they were having their own behavior issues at school. And so when I began to get professional help, I was able to be a different mother for my children. And that, I think back all the time, like, if I hadn't gotten the help, how much of everything that I was already carrying, I was going to pass on to my children.
Right, because they're watching you process your own grief, and that's how they're learning to process theirs. So where can someone begin, and this is for you, Vic, or Gabby, who is afraid to begin the conversation because it's taboo to dishonor your family by talking about what is private, because you're afraid that if you're undocumented, that you may get the officials involved. How can we begin to let people know that it is okay to ask for help, that it is okay to seek support? Where can they begin?
So one thing I would advise is if you go to our website, fsp.org, under our Talk Away the Dark platform, you'll see resources there on how to have conversations with people who may be reluctant to talk about their challenges. And there are a few things that we stress. One of them is that if you suspect that someone is thinking about suicide, if you think that someone's in a bad place mentally, try to have a conversation with them alone. Try to make sure they feel heard. I think oftentimes, even when Gabby talked about her story, and she talked about, you know, the things that she was going through, the message that we often get from the people around us is you're okay. You don't really need help. You don't need to be talking about this. Just pray about it. And what we don't always do is create safe space for that person to say, but this is what I am feeling, and to validate and acknowledge those feelings. So I think it starts with creating that safe space for people to be able to talk about the challenges that they're facing. But then make sure that you validate their feelings. And then also try to, if that person is in a place where you feel like they are really considering suicide, you want to make sure that you connect them to resources. We tell people all the time, 988 is available. Sometimes people who are not willing to talk with someone face to face, they're willing to pick up a phone and call 988 and talk to a professional there. I had an experience just last week with another gentleman, and I told him, call several times. You know, if you need to, call several times. Sometimes getting a different voice gives you a different perspective. So we encourage people to reach out, seek help. But we also encourage those folks around them to create safe space for them to be able to talk about the things that they're struggling with.
I'd like to thank both of our guests, Vic Armstrong and Gabby Vargas. Thank you again. Let's continue to keep this conversation going. Today we are talking away the dark. I want to thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Our thanks to Liz Hernandez, the AFSP's Vic Armstrong, and Gabby Vargas for their time and dedication to better mental health. To find out more about Talk Away the Dark, please visit afsp.org. And if you or someone you know is in crisis, please call or text 988. For the full show and more stories like this, download the I'm Listening podcast on the Odyssey app or visit imlistening.org.
Did you know that those with mental health challenges can be right in front of our eyes, but still go unseen? Behind some smiles, there's hidden pain, because our struggles aren't always on the surface. And they can affect anyone, anywhere, at any time. Our Black youth are at a higher risk for depression, anxiety, and other mental health struggles. Only 1 in 4 seeks treatment, and the stigma lingers. It's okay not to feel okay. There's strength in connecting and seeking help. Break the barriers, break the silence. Sharing is healing. Share, connect, get informed. Your mental health is in your hands. Visit melaninthriving.com/mental health in your hands.
This message brought to you by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, November 4th at 8 p.m. benefiting the Bonnie Fang Foundation, and Monday, November 18th at 8 p.m. benefiting the Veterans Social Club. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. The Nevada Partnership for Homeless Youth, or NPHY, is hosting the 8th Annual Nevada Youth Homelessness Summit next Friday, November 8th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Las Vegas City Hall. Help build the movement to end youth homelessness across Nevada. You can get the details or register to attend at nphy.org/summit24. That's nphy.org/summit24. The City of Henderson and Nuwu Art are hosting a free Indigenous American Heritage Celebration in honor of National Native American Heritage Month on Sunday, November 10th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Water Street Plaza, 240 South Water Street. The festival includes live music, dancing, storytelling, arts and crafts workshops, artisan vendors, authentic foods, and more. Get all the details at cityofhenderson.com. That's cityofhenderson.com. Collaboration Center's third annual Harvesting Hope Family Fall Festival and Community Resource Fair is happening on Saturday, November 16th from 12 to 3 p.m. at Collaboration Center's campus. This free inclusive event features a sensory-rich petting zoo, extensive resource fair, and fall festival activities for those of all abilities. Get all the details at collablv.org. That's collablv.org. And the Get Launched Vegas Finale Showcase by Positively Arts is taking place on Saturday, November 16th, with pre-show entertainment and cocktail hour from 1:15 to 2:15 p.m. and showtime from 2:30 to 5 p.m. at Notoriety. This transformative performance experience, inspired by American Idol, offers aspiring performers free training, mentorship, and a chance to shine on stage. Get your tickets or find out more at notorietylive.com. That's notorietylive.com.